Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Patty James, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Gregory Bunke, MD. Dr. Greg Bunke is a plastic hand and microsurgeon. He received his MD from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. He completed his residency in plastic and reconstructive surgery at Stanford University and did a fellowship in hand and microsurgery at the Davies Medical Center in San Francisco, where he remains in practice. Dr. Bunke is board certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery and has a certificate of added qualification in surgery of the hand. He is a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and a member of several societies, including the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, the American Society for Reconstructive Surgery, and the American Society for Surgery of the Hand. Dr. Bunke has published numerous articles related to a wide variety of plastic, hand, and microsurgery topics. Dr. Bunke.
Thank you very much, Patty. And thank you all for coming. This is really an honor to be here, and I have this beautiful view, but you should turn around and take a look at the view every once in a while because it is gorgeous. So I'm going to be talking about really clinical medicine and miracles of microsurgery. I just want to warn all of you that there are going to be some intraoperative pictures and some gory pictures, so I apologize for that ahead of time. Just turn away or look away if it's a problem for you. But microsurgery, first of all, what is microsurgery? Microsurgery is a field of medicine, really a field of surgery, and it's simply a technique that uses the microscope really to repair blood vessels. It's really a simple concept. It's being able to magnify and use tools to repair things that are very small, like blood vessels and nerves. And veins and lymphatic vessels. This is a new thing for us as well, this lymphatic surgery. This is just a picture of the operating room microscope, and the scope has two heads on it, and these are usually set 180 degrees apart so that the person can have the hand here, and then we could be sitting up opposite each other and see through the same field. And this allows the area to be magnified up to 20 times, and now the newer microscopes up to 40 times, which is actually very helpful for some of the very small vascular repairs that we do. Just to show the dimensions, this is a micro suture. This is about a 10-0 suture. You can see the needle there in relation to the size of a penny or a dime. And then when you magnify that, this is just a magnified picture of this suture, and this is a blood vessel that it's actually a lymphatic vessel that's been repaired. So when we repair vessels, we suture the tube by putting little knots around it, and up until the 1960s, this technique didn't really exist. And this person named Harry Bunke, who happens to be my father, local plastic surgeon, started this whole idea, and I'll talk a little bit about how he came up with the ideas and developed the technology in this history portion of this talk. The great thing about microsurgery is it's a technique that's always looking for answering problems, and we're constantly coming up with new solutions for different problems, knowing that we now have this technique to be able to repair small things that are potentially very helpful for patients. This is sort of the topics we'll cover: history of microsurgery, what is microvascular surgery, replantation surgery, which is putting things back on that have been chopped off, which is kind of the gory part, and then microneurosurgery, which is really peripheral nerve surgery. We don't do any intracranial or back surgery, but we do a lot of peripheral nerve surgery, nerve injuries in the arms and the legs. And then microvascular breast reconstruction, which I think has been taking off because this is a type of breast reconstruction that does not require an implant for reconstructing the breast after cancer resection. and toe transplants or multiple toe transplants for patients who have lost multiple fingers. And then the last topic is something that we've just started over the last 5 years, which is transgender surgery or microsurgery for transgender patients, specifically transgender men who were once women that want to have a phallus, or that's a scientific or the medical term for a penis. And I'll show how we can create that from pretty much from nothing, from somebody's arm. San Francisco is really the epicenter of the birth of microsurgery, mostly because of Harry Bunke, who most consider the father, is not only my father and my kid's grandfather, and they're all both here, and thank you for coming to this talk. But he died about 10 years ago, and he was a real idea generator, but also was very concerned about trying to follow through on ideas and trying to get results. This is just a picture of one of the very first operating microscopes that had this concept of something called a diploscope, where you could see from both sides in, and this is actually another entry point to the microscope, so you could attach a camera, and then your assistants, the scrub nurse, could actually look through this eyepiece and see what was going on at the same time. This was developed by Zeiss in the mid-1960s, and the third microscope was actually sent to my father from Germany. My father spent some time in East Grinstead, and most importantly in the Glasgow Infirmary during his time of training, which was in the mid-1950s, and worked with this gentleman named Tom Gibson, who was really one of the major pioneers that we don't hear about in transplantation surgery. He was the first to do homografts and understand the fate of skin in homografts. Homografts is taking tissue from one person and transplanting it to another person. We'll also talk about autografts, which is taking something from your own body and transplanting it to another part of the body, like a toe to make a thumb. Prior to microsurgery, if somebody had a hole in the back of their heel like this from an accident, the best way to treat this would be to do a cross leg flap. So this is looking at the back, this is the foot, and this is the hole in the back of the foot. And so you create a peninsula of tissue and attach it to this, and the new blood vessels sort of grow in from the sides over about a 3-week period. So this poor patient has to be in this position for about 3 weeks. And ultimately, when you detach it, you get a pretty good piece of tissue, but it takes a long time. They're hospitalized during that time. It's very uncomfortable. You can't really do it in older patients because they just can't stay in that position for a long time. This is an old technique as well. It was developed by Tagliacozzi in the late 1500s, and that used for nasal reconstruction, as in this patient here who lost a portion of her nose, and then we used a portion of the arm and actually attached it here. And then after a 3-week period of being in that position, it's detached and ultimately get a reasonable looking nose. But again, the skin color is not quite the same. It's a little different texture. We could do that now all in one stage with microsurgery. During my father's time there, he met one of the researchers was a gentleman named Stuart Milton, who was working on a pig model and could find that if he could find this piece of tissue and find the artery that flowed into the tissue and then the vein that flowed out of the tissue, and that he could actually create a peninsula of tissue that would survive on its own as an island of skin. And so my father said, well, why not just cut it here and there, and then transplant the tissue to another part of the body and hook up the blood vessels. And nobody had done that. It was kind of something that was novel and unusual, and there was really none of the technique out there. So he started trying to develop this idea of repairing blood vessels that were less than a millimeter in diameter or less. The biggest problem was finding micro sutures, micro needles. They didn't really have any, and the suture material was all much too big. Instrumentation was made for larger vessel repairs, and the suturing technique didn't exist. Patency was trying to keep the blood vessels open so that they didn't clot off, and that was a big problem early on too. This is some of his early tools. This is called a jeweler's forcep, which comes from a jewelry business where people use these forceps to work with fine down to fine points. And we actually call them jeweler's forceps. We use something very similar to that even nowadays. And just some other techniques that he was trying to develop. This is all early stuff. He was doing this all in our home. So I was kind of seeing a lot of this as I was growing up. The first really successful early microsurgery was actually silk that was unwound from a cocoon. So this is a cocoon, and you can hardly see it here, but this is a 4-0 silk, which is a relatively small silk. And then this is a very small piece of cocoon silk that he then put through a piece of metal that he sharpened and was able to actually do a 1-millimeter vessel repair. And that was his goal. If he could do a 1-millimeter vessel repair, then you could put fingers back on, because that's about the size of a digital artery and vein in a finger. So that was his goal. Then he was able to metallize the end of the suture and actually was able to get nylon that was small enough. And his first model was really the rabbit ear, which was the stuff that he did actually in our home. So we had all of these rabbits for pets that had ears that were in some fashion alive or not alive. So after 57 attempts at putting the rabbit ear back on, he was successful with this. And this was in about 1964. And he first presented at the Plastic Surgery Research Council and really had difficulty getting people enthusiastic about this because it was too really hard to do. And the thought of getting up in the middle of the night to put somebody's finger back on was kind of a ridiculous thought to everybody. Now we do it all the time. So I'm going to move now from the I'll talk about history of toe transplantation too in a little bit later, but I want to talk first about replantation. So replantation is a term we use to put things back on that have been chopped off. Usually it's fingers, where we repair arteries, veins, nerves, and tendons and bones. But we also replant fingers, hands, arms, feet, legs, ears. I'll show you some ears, lips, tongues. People actually chop their tongues off occasionally from fights or being in a car accident. Parts of the face and the penis, believe it or not. And that's usually something that they do to themselves, unfortunately. This is just in case you need to know what to do with your amputated finger or your friend's amputated finger. You should take the finger, put it in a slightly moistened gauze, it can be tap water, and then put that into a Ziploc baggie. And then put it on ice. You don't want to freeze it. You want to just keep it cold. It's supposed to be sort of refrigerated. And then just bring it to the emergency room. They will figure out how to get that patient to a replant center or to us. I'm going to go through some cases now. They get kind of gory, so prepare yourself. This is just what we can do. This is unfortunately a guy who had caught his hand in a cheese cutting factory. And fortunately, these are all chopped off relatively sharply. The sharper the finger is chopped off, the more likely it is that we could put it back together because we can find the part to repair on either side and hasn't been terribly damaged. So this is now what has happened. It takes about 2 to 3 hours per finger. So this is about a 6 to 8 hour operation. And then this is now after a year. We often do secondary operations 2 or 3, 4 months down the road so that they can get their fingers moving because a lot of times there's scar tissue around tendons and joints, and we work very hard to try to get those moving as much as possible. It'd be ridiculous to put a finger back on that's then stiff for the rest of their life. So we try to make sure that they get their fingers moving as quickly as possible and as the best that we can. And it may take several months and a year or to do that. The ring avulsion injury, I'm wearing a ring tonight, Janet, because I'm married to Janet. And I don't wear a ring often because it is a very dangerous thing. And especially for people who are doing construction or, you know, climbing cyclone fences like kids. And this is exactly what happened. This is a gentleman who was jumping over a fence to get his 4-year-old son at his school and caught his ring and unfortunately did something called a degloving of the finger. So the finger is not cut off sharply. It was pulled off, as you can see, and left this part of the finger there. So the skin has been sort of taken off as a piece of a glove. And then it dislocated at the joint. This is the one side of the joint you could see here, the PIP joint.
And then here's the ring, the offensive ring. And then here is the finger back on and taking a piece of the skin here to help cover some of the area here, as well as nerve grafting and vein grafting. And here he is now at about a year, year and a half out. And you can see he's got this sort of extension. It's never perfect. He's got this sort of flexion. And this is just a little video of him opening and closing his hands. And then this is him. Just, you can see, he can't flex the very tip of the finger, but it's certainly better than not having a finger. This is a hand replant, hand off, and then hand back on. The hand replants are very, actually do pretty well because this is larger structures that we could put back together. So the first thing we do is put these shunts in to try to get the hand to get perfused as quickly as possible, because the sooner we can get the perfusion into the hand, the better the muscles in the hand and less likely that the hand will degenerate. So we try to do that first, and then we know we've got the hand perfused. We can then do all of the tendons and the nerves. There's probably about 20 tendons we have to repair during that whole period, along with two nerves and then all the bony fixation. So this hand replant takes about 10 hours to do. And this is immediately postoperatively. And you can see this is the side that this was a machete injury. So it's a very sharp injury. And fortunately, he has this sort of motion. This is a more mangled extremity where he was crushed and looks like we can't probably put any of this back on. And with vein grafts, we take veins from the leg and use that as a conduit to bring new blood supply to these fingers, because the blood vessels have been damaged from here to here. So we need some way to bring blood supply to the fingers, so we can use conduits from the leg as a vein graft. And that's what's showing the vein graft. And here's the hand. We weren't able to save all of his fingers. This is what the hand looked like, and this is what he is now, and he's got that kind of result. And that's about after it. Now, scalp replants are very, this is not as common, thank God, but it is unfortunately, women who have long hair that are very thick hair can often catch their ponytails and power takeoff and sort of tear the entire scalp off. And it comes off right about this level and then back down. You'll see it goes all the way back down to the base of the neck. And so we hook up the vessels on both sides of the scalp, and all of it perfuses. And actually, you can see her hair grow. This is a year after her. It's incredible and her hair actually grows. Thank you very much. And we're thinking about using this as a way of treating male pattern baldness. That's not funny, but it is a joke. This is not funny either. So this is, unfortunately, a man who was unhappy, was hearing voices, and unfortunately chopped his penis off. And believe it or not, the blood vessels going to the penis are very similar to about the same size as the ones going to the fingers. And so we do microsurgical repair of the arteries and the veins and the nerves, and this person could not only urinate, because you hook up the urethra too, which is what the urine passes through, but he also has sensation because we're hooking up the nerves, and he has erogenous sensation, is able to have sex and live a reasonably good life. So ear replantation is actually really difficult because the blood vessels, you can imagine how small the blood vessels are around the ear. These are almost always attacks or an auto accident where something catches the ear and tears it off. And the sharper the ear comes off, the more likely it is that we could put these back on. We have to find an artery and a vein, because if you hook up the artery, then blood flows into the ear with the artery, and if we don't hook up a vein, then it'll just fill up with blood. So in this particular case, we were able to find a vein, but it didn't do very well. The vein actually clotted, so we used medicinal leeches, and I'll talk about this in depth in a couple minutes, but you use these medicinal leeches that actually have medication in their saliva that keeps the blood percolating through the part. And if you could do this for, you know, 6-7 days, then the ear survives. And you could see this is now at about almost 6 months out, and it survived. Tongue replant. This is the very first tongue that was ever replanted by my father and my partner, Rudy Buntick, who This poor 18-year-old was in a motor vehicle accident. We hit a tree and unfortunately was screaming and chopped and bit off his tongue. And that's a pretty big piece of tongue. So it actually has blood vessels. Oftentimes, the smaller pieces of tongue that are bitten off don't have blood vessels in them. So you can't really. So this is now him post-operatively. And you can see he became a baseball announcer. So he's able to speak pretty well and is actually an attorney now in Los Angeles. And I think he defends doctors. I'm not sure. So just to show the number, this comes from the American Society for Reconstructive Microsurgery, which is kind of our society that we can talk about replantation and microsurgery, which I'll talk about even further. But you can see this is 2015 numbers. Our numbers are increasing, but that's our specialty, and we get patients from all over the state, and that's our interest. And a lot of these other places are doing it somewhat. Medicinal leeches. Believe it or not, medicinal leeches are out there. There are companies that actually grow leeches specifically to be used for microsurgery. There's a company called BioPharm, in case you need one, in BioPharm in South Carolina and Leech USA. That's the one we use. Leech USA in New Jersey. who they actually develop medicinal leeches, and they're used frequently. The leech works by actually sucking a little bit of blood out of the part that has too much blood in it. Medicinal leeches are used specifically for venous outflow problems. So there's good flow in, the artery's flowing in well, but the vein is not flowing out well for some reason, and we can't reestablish the outflow. So if you can attach a leech to this part and have it bleed for a period of time. And the interesting thing about leech is it's like a perfect thing for these venous congested fingers, because in the actual leech saliva is this material called Herudin, which is like heparin. It's a blood thinner that is about 10,000 times more effective than heparin. And it can actually, in the part, you can actually see the leech attach, and then you can see the fingers start getting pink because there's better blood flow based on the bite and the saliva in the leech. The other thing is that Aeromonas hydrophila is one of the byproducts of the leech gut, and we have to cover that. So that's something that, and here's a leech that we use, and you just take them and you kind of stick them on this finger and they bite right on, and then they will get to be about 3 or 4 times its size, and in about 15, 20 minutes will just fall off, and then it's satiated, it's done, and the leech is gone. And then this is just showing you a finger that has good inflow but bad outflow. You can see the blood is sort of stagnated in the part. There's no outflow, so this finger was leeched multiple times and then ultimately survived. So microneurosurgery is basically repairing peripheral nerves. We've been using this something called processed nerve allograft from cadavers that helps us be able to deal with gaps in the nerve. We talked about gaps in blood vessels. We could just take the tube out of somebody's foot, but that doesn't leave much of a problem. If we take a nerve from somebody's leg as a nerve graft, then they have numbness in their foot and their leg. So we can now take this nerve graft right out of the freezer that has been processed, and it's all decellularized, so it doesn't have anti-rejection. They don't have to take anti-rejection medications. And this is just to show you the technique of doing a nerve repair, similar to doing an arterial repair. And this is probably about 15-time magnification. Just a couple clinical examples of using nerve grafts. This is a rope avulsion injury in a rodeo guy who unfortunately nearly tore off his finger, but we opened this up and you could see that there's a gap here in the nerve. Here's one of the ends of the nerves, and back here is another end of the nerve, and you can see it's just there's a big gap, and here's the other end that's been torn out. So now we can take this right out of the freezer and repair the nerve directly. Here's a nerve on one of the sides, digital nerve on one side, and the digital nerve repair. It's about a 3-centimeter gap. and actually this is now him about a year later, and you can see he's got pretty good range of motion, but also two-point discrimination tells us how good the sensation is objectively, and those numbers are almost within normal range. The microvascular transplantation is, so the term autotransplantation is moving a part from one part of our body to the other, as in the abdomen or the thigh for breast reconstruction, toes to hands, muscle transplants to take care of people who have lost muscle in their arm or in their face, skin transplants for big defects as well, and I'll show some of that. As opposed to allotransplant, I just want people to understand the difference between these two terms. We are doing transplantation, but it's autotransplantation. Allotransplantation is what everybody thinks about, heart, lung, kidney, and that's going from one person to another, and those people all have to take anti-rejection medications for the rest of their lives because you're constantly trying to reject that part that's been transplanted. So in autotransplantation, you don't have to do any of that because it's your own body's, your own tissue.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So talking about breast reconstruction, the two big flaps that we use for breast reconstruction are the deep flap, which is the deep inferior epigastric perforator flap that comes from the abdomen. It's the skin and fat from the abdomen. And if you take the skin from an abdominoplasty and you can find the blood vessels, we actually tease out the blood vessels and then hook those up to the internal mammary vessels. And then you can create an entire new breast for patients who have breast cancer. The good thing is by doing this, we don't use any abdominal muscles and the recovery is much faster. The other is the tug flap, and some patients don't have enough abdominal tissue or they've had abdominoplasty or liposuction, and the tissue that we take from the abdomen won't work. So we could take the inside of the thigh and make a breast with that. This is just a deep flap. This is a patient who had cancer in the left breast, recurrent new cancer in her right breast. She's having mastectomy on the right. We're going to do immediate reconstruction on the right breast and delayed reconstruction on the left breast. And here we have this is the abdomen. Legs are down here, head is up here, and the belly button is right there. And you can see this is now the tissue that has been taken away. We split down the rectus abdominis muscle and leave that muscle intact so you could still do sit-ups and don't ruin that. Because the blood vessels go all the way down to the aorta, basically, and so we can get long vessels, and then hook up these vessels to the internal mammary artery and vein, which is right here. This is cutting through the rib and finding those vessels and hooking up, just hooking up the flow through the tissues, and this is what it looks like long term. She's had it basically an abdominoplasty, and that tissue is, instead of throwing it away, used to make a breast. You could do the same thing for reconstructing the breast, only using the thigh based on the inside of the thigh, using the muscle called the gracilis muscle, and those blood vessels that go through the gracilis muscle go through the skin. We can find the blood vessel going to the gracilis muscle, which is a bigger blood vessel, and then hook that up. Here is the blood supply to this skin, and then you can shape it into a breast and make it into something that looks like a breast, and then this is somebody who has cancer in both breasts, or DCIS really, and wants to have reconstruction. And this is now, you can see where the scars are on the inside of the thigh. It's actually a pretty nice scar for breast reconstruction. Toe transplantation is something that I love doing because it's a sort of a magical operation. If somebody has no fingers or no thumb, and then you can take something from their feet and make it into a new thumb and something that changes their lives. And actually, my father was very interested in doing this and did it in primates, and we'll see that early on. But the concept of taking something from the toe to make a thumb or a finger dates back to the 1900s, turn of the century, believe it or not. And Nicola Doni did this by attaching the toe to the hand and like we saw those previous attached flaps, and hooking that toe there and leaving it in place for about 3 weeks, and then could detach it. It didn't work very well because he didn't hook up the nerves or the blood or the bone, so it was a kind of a floppy thumb. So my father's idea was, why not do it as one stage? And so he needed a model, and he uses the rhesus monkey as a model. But this story about how the rhesus monkeys, he was doing all of his research at our home. He did a little bit at Stanford and UC, but it was very expensive, and he was funding it all himself. So he was trying to find an inexpensive way to be able to do toe transplants in a primate. It turns out that one of his patients was a Pan Am flight attendant, and she told him that they were no longer flying. She was a cargo person. They were no longer flying monkeys from the Southeast Asia to the United States because they no longer, Sabin and Salk no longer needed the monkeys to make polio vaccine. If you recall the polio vaccine, it all goes back to this polio vaccine in the early 60s. Those of you who are old enough will remember taking a sugar cube with the little, well, that was monkey immunoglobulin. It was actually serum from a monkey who had been infected with polio. The monkeys can survive from polio. So you could take the blood of the monkey and we could eat it, and then we became immune. It basically solved the whole problem. Well, eventually they could make it in the laboratory. So they didn't need the monkeys. So for all of you that live in the peninsula, the Southeast Asian Primate Center is now the Humane Society. So that building was built for the Salk vaccine monkeys. And my father went down there and talked to him and said, hey, you know, I know that you're not going to need these monkeys anymore. Can I, you know, buy a couple of them? And there were veterinarians there, and they said, sure. So the veterinarians would take care of them. But he and I was about 10 years old, went down and actually went to the monkey and gave him a blast of ketamine. And once they fell asleep, they put him in our car, and we drove up to our house, and he started an IV, and he did the toe transplant. And after it was done, it took all day to do, he'd bring it back down to down to this place, and they'd take care of them. So he did this in two separate times on a monkey, and did the toe transplant, and was able to get the thumb to survive. And this is now about 3 weeks out, and you can see the monkey is using the hand, his newly reconstructed thumb, with to eat and to move around. And I have a picture of an X-ray that was taken that was an arteriogram that he actually snuck the monkey into Peninsula Hospital at 3 o'clock in the morning in 1965, and was able to do the arteriogram. So those were the days when you could do those kind of things. Then he did it, and then he was able to do it in a human. And the first one that was done in the United States, the first one was actually done in the world, was done in Great Britain. And the person who did it was one of my father's pupils who went back and was able to find a patient. But the second one was done on a gentleman who was a fireman from Redwood City who had lost his thumb. And then my father made these clay models in preparation to try to show the patient what it would look like to have this toe transplant. And then they did the toe transplant, and it's successful. And it was a very difficult operation, multiple take-backs. Sometimes 10 or 12 hours after surgery, the thumb would turn white, and he had to go back to the operating room. I remember this all happened when I was in high school, so it was very memorable to me. These toe transplants are really change people's lives. This is a gentleman who was actually an orthopedic resident in Canada, and he was sent to my father to try to reconstruct his hand because all he needed was really a pinch in this hand, because his other hand, he had lost, because of the motor vehicle accident, you could see he has a below elbow amputation, and he required 24-hour a day care, because he couldn't really use his right hand. As soon as he developed a pinch, he could drink, he could write, he could put his prosthesis on, so he became completely independent just by developing a pinch. And you can see this is how we attach and hold the bone in position. This is the sort of motion you get in these toes. They really act just like thumbs, believe it or not. And the foot is not beautiful. You know, it's you have a missing toe. But it really surprisingly has very little impact on gait and the ability to walk. Many of these patients are athletes. One was actually a quarterback at Cabrillo College. The very third toe transplant he ever did was a soccer star from who became the captain of the Ecuadorian soccer team. And did great. He became the captain of the Ecuadorian soccer team after he had his toe transplant. And the amazing thing about these great toe transplants is they change over time. This is about a year and a half out. This is a right great toe that was transplanted to a thumb. This is what that used to look like. That thumb, that toe used to look like this. But over about a year or so, it starts to change because you're no longer walking on it. It did have some, it was denerotized for a while, so it atrophies a little bit. But over time, these thumbs or toes or whatever we want to call them, toe-to-thumb transplants start to look like thumbs. And you could, I think this thumb actually looks more like the toe looks more like a thumb than it does a toe. We use the second toe for finger reconstruction frequently. And this is a person who had lost all of his fingers in a snowblower up in Auburn and unfortunately couldn't put him back on replantation. So we did two second toe transplants to give him grip. And you can see that he's got grip now. He runs a whitewater rafting company. That's his hand gripping the paddle. So it really changes, it brings their life back. They go from being completely, terribly depressed to feeling like they have a life again. This is a gentleman who was a plastic surgery resident in Mexico City, and during the earthquake in the mid-1980s, had his hand crushed, lost all his fingers. This is his hand after he had lost his fingers. You could see the amputation was basically through these joints. And we did two-finger toe transplant, and he is now a plastic surgeon and is working. He finished plastic surgery, actually spent some time in our laboratory learning microsurgery. And you can see this is now, you can see the fingers working. So he's back to being he lives actually in San Diego and works in Tijuana. He's kind of the reverse of what we often hear about. This is a gentleman who had a degloving injury, lost all of his fingers, and now has basically a mitten hand. So we created, we expanded the skin on the back of his hand, brought that to make a web space, pushed that skin in to make a web space so they could open his hand, and did a toe transplant. And then he said, "Can't you do something about these fingers?" And we said, "Yeah, well, we could transplant your second toe." So we did that. That's 4 months later. And then he goes, "Well, what about these fingers?" Well, we said we could take your fourth toe. So that's what we did. We took the fourth toe and transplanted. And so he has a thumb, two second toes, and two fourth toes. And he's got a pretty functional hand with that. The last topic I wanted to talk about was transgender microsurgery. And this is a relatively new thing that we've been doing for the last about 4 or 5 years. And it's the creation of a phallus, basically a penis for patients who are female that want to become transgender patients who are going from female to male. It's a microsurgical transplantation of the forearm skin, and I'll show you that operation. And it gives them several things. They can urinate through this because you can tube the skin on itself and hook up the urethra so they can actually stand up and urinate, which is very important for them. They can have actually a sensation because you can take the nerve that goes to the clitoris and attach it to the phallus, and they can get erogenous sensation. And they secondarily, they can have devices put into their new phallus so that they can have erections and penetration. And so this is in order of importance to these patients. It's mostly they would like to have a phallus. They'd like to stand and urinate and achieve penetration. But the most important thing is actually having something that they can makes them feel like a man rather than a woman. WPATH is the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, and they have guidelines. Top surgery in transgender patients is removing the breasts in patients who go from women to men. and adding implants for men who want to become women. Bottom surgery is more complicated. It's creating a phallus in transgender men, and it's creating a vagina from the skin of the penis. And that is not, that's something that's, you can't change later. That's if you have to make that decision. So all these patients go through an extensive workup for, they have to have a mental health professional, and they have to have well-qualified, that they have to have well-documented gender dysphoria, meaning that they don't feel comfortable being the gender that they are. They have to have the capacity to make consent. They have to be at least 18 years and older in this country. In Europe, it's a little bit younger in some countries. They have to have hormone therapy for at least 12 months and 12 months of being in that role. And most of these patients have been living the life of a man since they were children. So this is going to be a radial forearm, taking the forearm skin and turning that into a phallus. So this is the skin of the forearm. We can take this and follow the blood vessels up into the forearm. And then this is just a diagrammatic version of this radial. This is a template that we make. And this is just a diagrammatic scheme of tubing it on itself. So the inside of this is now the skin. And then the outside of this is the skin of the rest of the flap. So just to show, these are surgical photos, so beware. This is now the skin that's going to be skinned off of the hand. We're going to put skin graft there that's taken from the thigh to replace the skin that's taken there. But this skin is in and itself alive, because we can take these blood vessels that flow in and out. So here's the artery, and here's our one vein, two veins. Here's the nerve that supplies this area. So this is tubed on itself, and we'll hook up the urethra to this end of the tube, and then they can urinate out the end of the penis. But then this portion of it is then wrapped around the outside of it. And this is just a picture of the same thing. And this is the phallus. This is now the tube. This is a catheter going through the central portion that I was talking about that makes the neo-urethra. And this is the blood vessels repaired. And this is creating something that looks like the end of a penis. And that's the end product. And this is another picture of the... And this is about 3-4 months down the road. It does look like... And here's... this is skin graft that's been harvested to put over the arms, where the skin graft, and you can see the hand still works quite well. Some of these patients develop some lymphedema in the hand and get swelling, but they're very happy with the results. So that's that. The final topic I was going to talk about is microsurgical scalp reconstruction in a patient who lost most of her scalp from a motor vehicle accident 3 years earlier from the time we saw her. That area was treated with skin grafting. She had chronic open wounds on the scalp and infection of the bone or osteomyelitis of the cranium. And this is the unfortunate patient who has, you can see their skin is breaking down. She's got chronic infection. It's pulling her eyebrows up because the skin graft is constantly compressed. So she said, is there anything you can do? And there's really nothing from a microsurgical point of view. You can't take hair. There's no big hair-bearing area on your body that you could take and reconstruct that. So in jest, my father said, well, if you happen to have a twin sister, you could take skin from her. And she says, I do have a twin sister. And she came in from the waiting room, and she said, you're going to do what? And so this is an identical twin sister that took the scalp from her and transplanted it to her sister, did not need the anti-rejection medications because they were identical twins. They're basically clones. So they did not have to take any anti-rejection medication, never had any problems, and in three operations basically reconstructed. This is from the donor to the recipient. Again, the third operation, donor to recipient. You can see this is... post-op follow-up, this is the recipient, and here's the donor. It leaves very little scar on her scalp. That's the defect that was taken, basically that scalp skin. And this is them getting married, and it's pretty hard to tell which one is the donor and which is the recipient. So just some of the first, I've talked about most of them, but there's our group and Harry Buckey has done a ton of firsts, and I think the most important ones from our point of view is this toe transplant that showed that we could actually move tissue from one part of the body to the other. He did actually the first microvascular transplant to reconstruct the scalp at Oak Knoll Hospital, and a number of other things here that I've listed. But this is just sort of an action shot of us doing a double toe transplant. So we're taking this team is operating on the right foot, this team is operating on the left foot, and we're operating at the hand here, preparing this hand for transplanting these toes up here. So everybody's, there's the three operative teams working simultaneously, anesthesia over here. And then this is now using the microscope to repair these little blood vessels that will then revascularize the toes. And we have a bunch of video machines like this in the room because we've got people that we're trying to train. So it's very helpful for them to see how to actually do the technique. And this is our group. I'm very lucky to work with these guys, Andrew Watt, Rudy Buntick, Walter Lynn, Bob Aksafa, and myself. And this is all, if you ever want to get more grossed out, you can go to this www.bunky.org. This is our textbook, which is out of print, unfortunately, but it is free to look at in the on the web and under the textbook section. Microsurgeon.org is Rudy Buntick's showing exactly how to do these operations. A lot of the drawings that you saw came from that website. And thank you very much. Happy to.
Well, anybody have any questions?
If you can reattach nerve from the freezer, get a nerve segment, how about spinal injuries?
So, yeah, it is a good question. The problem with spinal cord injury, so a peripheral nerve is a different thing than the nerves in the brain and the nerves in the spinal cord. The actual, like the actual cell body where the cell is in the dorsal, is way back up in the, either in the spinal cord or in the dorsal ganglion, and the entire cell is in the extremity. So if you cut this, you're really not cutting you're not killing an entire nerve cell. You're just cutting it off. And the amazing thing is that we have the ability to grow nerve. So that nerve will actually find that nerve fiber, which is really a cell, will actually find its way down a tube, which is what we do. We hook up the tube so that the nerve fibers can grow down. It's really a remarkable thing. But unfortunately, in the spinal cord, you're actually, when you injure the spinal cord, you're injuring the cells themselves. And that when you kill the cell, there's no way to bring it back. There's some new work on trying to use glues that we might be able to use to help with spinal cord injury. It's very preliminary, but it has to be done within 24 hours, and maybe that will fuse those cells. But it's very early.
On the topic of new things, what's on the horizon? What are you experimenting on that you couldn't talk about in the presentation? Those are all things that you've done.
I think the and it's a pretty complex topic, but lymphedema is another thing that we're doing some work with. Lymphedema comes from after taking lymph nodes out of the armpit, patients could have lymphedema. The most common lymphedema in the world is actually in the lower extremity, and it's almost all from infection, from filariasis, from infection that people get from walking barefoot. But in this country, it's almost all from breast cancer and taking the nodes out. What we can do is hook up these lymphatic vessels, which are plugged because they have no place to go, and hook those to small veins, which are flowing, and then the lymphatic fluid slowly flows out of the arm through the veins. And we can also transplant the actual lymph node and hook that, put that down in the arm and hook up the blood vessels to that. So the lymph node will actually act like a sponge and suck some of the lymph fluid out and have it go back out through the venous system, if that makes sense.
So on something like that, do you have to get government approval, or is there tests, or is this just your best efforts and the patient understands that there's risk that they're running?
Yeah, they know the risk. I mean, this is all – people who come to us for that kind of stuff have seen our research work, so they're kind of interested in it. A lot of the surgical stuff that we're doing has been done, but not as well because we now have the techniques with the microscope to really repair the teeny little blood vessels. People were doing it with – trying to do it with larger stuff, and it didn't work. I think the whole concept of transplantation of organs and parts from like the hand transplant – you've all seen hand transplants and arm transplants – that's still something in evolution. The problem is that you're still having to take this horrible anti-rejection medication, and because it's skin, it's because it's very, it causes a huge reaction, a foreign body reaction or foreign reaction. You have to take very high doses of the anti-rejection medication. So that's all going to have to take place in the immunological world. The immunologists have to figure that all out. We can do it surgically.
So who's working on brain stuff?
Brain stuff? Not us. There was some period of time that microsurgery was being used to do intracranial to extracranial. So people were having an acute stroke. You could hook up the superficial temporal artery to the middle cerebral artery and try to revascularize. The middle cerebral artery is the vessel that may have clotted off in somebody who's had a stroke, but that hasn't really helped those situations.
But that's a whole different arena.
Yes. Oh, neurosurgery is inside the brain is a much different deal for us.
Where do your patients come from?
They're mostly from the California area. I mean, certainly the trauma patients all come from Northern California, although a lot of patients, for example, if somebody chops off their hand or finger, we can probably put their finger back on within, 12 to 16 hours. So that means that they can get transported from almost, Nevada, Southern Oregon. We've gotten patients from there. If it's a hand amputation, the muscle in the hand or the arm deteriorates much faster than a finger does, which doesn't have them. The muscle is the part that deteriorates really quickly. So we have about 6 to 8 hours. If they're put on ice and not frozen but just kept refrigerated, we have about 6 to 10 hours maybe for hand replant.
What about the patients who do elective type surgeries?
Well, they come from all over. I mean, this textbook is actually people spend a lot of time. We've had patients from – I just had a guy from India come here to have a toe transplant because he was able to find us through the web. I mean, the web has actually helped us a lot to get the word out and know that these techniques are available.
Okay, so maybe this next question won't pertain then, but I was just wondering about, insurance. I mean, and is this just for the people who can't afford it? Or, because toe transplants to make their life easier on a hand, maybe is that elective and insurance won't pay for it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal. I mean, it's 8 hours of surgery in the hospital for, a week. So it's an expensive operation. The emergency stuff we can't turn down because those are people that need help, and we're the ones that do it, so we never turn that down. But to do the elective stuff, we do everything we can to try to get some payment for it, especially for the hospital, or else they go out of business.
So you're probably not the only clinic that does this. What's the situation in the United States and in Europe and Asia and so on?
Yeah, that's a good question. We on the West Coast, we're kind of the people that do most of it, and we have trainees that go to different places. There's a very good place in Baltimore that does microvascular surgery for the hand. Believe it or not, Japan is probably the leader in – Japan and Taiwan are the leaders in – one of the leaders in microsurgery. They've done more toe transplants than we have ever done. They're probably tripled our numbers. France is a very big – Europe, Spain has now become probably the leader in microsurgery. It's interesting.
Spain?
Spain.
Okay. Well, our thanks to Dr. Gregory Bunke for your amazing program here today. I think we're all in awe. I know I am. My goodness. And we also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.